Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 194, and we're marching towards Thabo Bosiu with Lieutenant General George Cathcart, or sitting on horseback among King Moshoeshoe's Basutu warriors, armed with a musket. Take your pick. We're going to hear about the Battle of Beria. The outcome would underline Basutu mastery of their land and lead ultimately to Lesotho's independence. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. First things first. As you heard last episode, soldiers from various regiments in the British Army in the Cape mounted rifles, totaling 2,500 troops, were invading Moshoeshoe's kingdom. The British were trying to secure the northern parts of the Cape colony and believed that by crushing Moshoeshoe, the Transorangia would be rid of raiding and chaos. The fact that a whole range of people were raiding and causing chaos seemed to have escaped the attention of Cathcart and his commanders. As you know, there's a long list of these renegades, but because Moshoeshoe was the most organized African leader in the territory, it stood to reason that it must be his people causing the trouble. The Basutu's main opponents, though, weren't the Boers under Pretorius, or the Rolong under Maroka, or the Griqua, nor were they the Bastards under Pieter Davids and Carolus Baiki, or even the Khora bandits under Gert Taibosch. No, the Basutu regarded Sekonyela's Batlokwa as their main opposition in the area. And it was Sekonyela's complaints to the British about Moshoeshoe that set off this recent marching business. Sure, there's no debate about whether or not Moshoeshoe and his allies had been carting off Boer stock, raiding when they could. This was true. What was really going on was that Cathcart wanted to end the ongoing Eighth Frontier War, and he thought that by hammering Moshoeshoe, a possible future conflict could be avoided, and he could then concentrate on the Amaxhosa further south. There's an excellent analysis of what happened during Major General George Cathcart's abortive Basutoland campaign of 1852, written in 1995 by David Sachs of the South African Military History Society. So this massive force, the biggest British army to take the field in South Africa since they invaded the Cape half a century before, included artillery and engineers and regiments like the Queen's West Surrey, the Black Watch, the Battalion Highland Light Infantry, the Rifle Brigade, mounted detachments of the 12th Royal Lancers, and two companies of the Cape Mounted Rifles. When we left off last episode, Moshoeshoe had partially relented to Cathcart's demands and sent 3,500 cattle, saying more would follow. Cathcart was unimpressed. He'd ordered 30,000 in total and 10,000 immediately, along with 1,000 horses. Moshoeshoe had asked for more time than the 3 days to do this. The British commander gave him 4. It was an impossible demand. After waiting for 4 days, instead of sending a follow-up message or declaring war, warning Moshoeshoe that time was up, the British Major General Sommer just marched into the Basutu territory. Now you'd imagine this would count as a surprise attack. Well, it's true that Moshoeshoe was surprised, but you can't really call this a surprise attack. In strict terms, that's when an army pitches up and starts shooting at you while you're sitting on the toilet or quaffing a few cold beers, usually at night, or when your men are sleeping. Cathcart moved off at dawn. It was going to take his force hours to reach their first objectives. That was more than enough time for Moshoeshoe to recover from what was a heinous break from English military tradition. No war was declared after all. The Basutu king moved fast, and within an hour, more than 3,000 warriors on their horses were ready, muskets loaded. The king had not been idle in recent years. His people had been studying and practicing how to fight a mobile European army moving inside mountain kingdoms, particularly their tactics. Cathcart had also left half his force behind and then split up the remaining soldiers for this assault. At dawn on the 20th of December 1852, a dismayed and indignant Moshoeshoe heard that 3 British divisions had crossed the Caledon River into Basutoland from the north and then swung south towards Thabo Bosiu and were about to cross the Beria escarpment. This is a few kilometres to the east of where Maseru is today. On the British left flank was the cavalry under Lieutenant Colonel George Thomas Napier, joined by 233 others, including 119 men of the Cape Mounted Rifles and 114 men of the 12th Lancers. So let's consider the orders. Well, after the fiasco of the Battle of Berea, there was going to be a slew of allegations, a bevy of counter-allegations, and a basket of deplorable controversies. Cathcart said later he'd ordered the cavalry to sweep along the northern shoulder of the Berea as a reconnaissance move, then to canter down the eastern edge until they reached the valley floor. That would mean that the main target, Tabo Basu, would be right in front of them, on the right. They were not to approach using the Berea Plateau, merely skirt it, and then were to round up cattle, but only those directly in their path. "Oh, no, you don't," said Napier later. "You ordered me to round up all the cattle I could see on the plateau before moving on." This confusion emerged later, of course, but keep it in mind as we hear what happened. Did Napier have to round up some or all the cattle? Cathcart had emphasized his interest in cattle, and this entire war had started ostensibly over the fact that Moshoeshoe had failed to deliver the 10,000 immediately. Naturally, Napier should be collecting cows as he went. No? Well, no. At least that's Cathcart's version. From where Cathcart surveyed the Berea Plateau, it appeared Napier would not have to travel on the flattish top. But in reality, the cavalry would have to ride over the tabletop because certain features were out of Cathcart's view, such as a saddle linking Berea to the high ground from where the British moved off. The lack of a proper map didn't help. I'll share a map drawn by French missionary Casali on my blog later, just for reference. According to the initial plan, a central column of 500 men, including 271 soldiers of the 73rd Regiment, 102 others of the 43rd, and 90 of the Rifle Brigade, along with around 140 men of the Cape Mounted Rifles and artillery and a squadron of Amamfengu horsemen, were supposed to move straight up and over the Berea, driving cattle before them. This was the centre column. They would descend onto the southern valley and then aim at Tabo Basu under command of Cathcart. But Cathcart had a change of heart just before dawn, broke up this force again, sending Lieutenant Colonel Eyre with a company of the 43rd to head off down the other side, the right or the west of this Berea plateau, to join up with him on the flatland below by midday. Then they would march on Tabo Basu. So that meant Cathcart's column was reduced to just 400 men. No worries, he thought. What could go wrong, as my dad used to say. Things went pear-shaped for the British from the moment they trotted off. As Eyre's men reached the plateau, they began rounding up every cow they could see. This prolonged cattle hunt included gunfights with the Basutu guarding these animals, slowing down the British advance to the south. It also led to civilians, including women, being shot by the Lancers. And this was going to lead to payback later, on the day of the 20th of December. Well, the three sections moving separately out of sight of each other, midday was the deadline for them to join up, ready for the final push onto the Tabo Basu Heights, finally seize King Moshoeshoe, not to mention all his cattle. Midday came and went, and Eyre was nowhere to be found because he was still gallivanting across the Berea with his men, rounding up the mooing cows. Meanwhile, Napier had so far had a successful day. He'd collected 4,500 head of cattle and was heading along the northeastern side of the Berea, the opposite side to Eyre, and out of sight of Cathcart and his column in the centre. Moshoeshoe was receiving intelligence reports, and at times could actually see all three sections of his enemy galloping about, marching steadily towards him, gathering his cattle. He could also see clearly that the force his main adversary, Major General Cathcart, was now leading, was underwhelming as it reached the Putiastana Valley below his centre of power, Tabo Basu. By midday, Cathcart's column had halted on the south side of the Berea, near a knoll above a stream, and about 3 kilometres from Tabo Basu. The Major General looked about. Where were Napier and Eyre, he wondered. Surely they would heave into view within a short while. But all he could see in front of him were thousands of Basutu horsemen, maybe 2,000, possibly 3. He was going to be hit from two sides simultaneously. On the right flank, Moshoeshoe's sons, Letsi and Nehemiah, were itching to score a few points against the British, and they had reason to be confident. This Basutu force was extremely mobile and well organized. Cathcart paled when he realized he was alone on the veldt with his 400 men, no sign of reinforcements. Later, he would write that the actions of the Basutu reminded him of the Cossacks, nimble and cool under fire. Nehemiah led a sally forth, but was faced by an equally cool and impassive group of British troops. Whatever your personal point of view, the actions of both of these foes should be admired. Caught as they were in a tide of time, history throwing them at each other, both sides disciplined under fire. There was no panic, no rending of garments and shrieking of terror. There, on the Putiastana flats, as the powerful Basutu horsemen circled, the men of the 43rd Regiment sat down to light a few fires and have lunch inside their squares. Nehemiah was to say later he was particularly impressed by this act of courage, and Cathcart was also to say he was impressed by the Basutu's skill and calmness. Cathcart was actually more than impressed, because it emerged that he was shaken to his core. The British had planned an elaborate show of force, only to face a foe that appeared to be more powerful and more skilled. The arrogant idea that his flashing sword-holding lances and hundreds of men would scare an African opponent had been shown up as disastrous hubris. He was intimidated, not Mashweshwe. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Colonel George Napier, over on the west side of the Berea, found things were spiralling out of control. He had been cut off and faced the first real counterattack of any force from the Basutu. Napier was happily minding his own business, along with his 233 men on horseback, when suddenly 700 Basutu horsemen under Mashweshwe's other son, Morapo, attacked his rearguard. Napier's cavalrymen had just moved through a gorge and had no idea that lurking within this gorge were 700 men on horses stroking their muskets, waiting for the British and the Cape Mounted Rifles to pass. They attacked, and a detachment of 30 mounted lancers under Major Tottenham was cut off. Their horses were heavy chargers, typical of the European theatre of operations, massive animals. The enemy, the Basutu, were riding bareback on tiny little Basutu ponies, mixed breeds they'd cobbled together over decades from the first Boer ponies they purchased. These animals are not only small, they are notorious. I've ridden Basutu ponies, and they remind me of quicker mules, and mules are extremely cranky animals, so too the Basutu pony. It gives you a remarkably sentient side eye, and if you're not up to the ride, this little beast will toss you off in a flash. The Basutu pony is much more mobile and nimble on steep broken ground, and the lancers could not turn or move quickly enough with their powerful charges as they faced the Basutu. The warriors sheathed their muskets for the final moments of this part of the Battle of Berea, because the lancers had made a fatal wrong turn in the chaos and ended up riding along a watercourse straight towards a dead end. As they reached the stony path that was impassable to their large horses, the Basutu switched to their assegais and battle axes and wiped out the group of lancers. A handful escaped. Five men of the Cape Mounted Rifles were also caught on the high ground near the Berea mission station and shot dead. At the same time, Eyre's men on the east side of the Berea plateau were also in a spot of bother. Because these troops were mostly unmounted, it had taken far longer for them to round up the cattle. Then they found it even more difficult to control animals they were lowing and afraid, frightened by the sounds of battle. These could easily crush a soldier as they stampeded, run right over him, and by 1 p.m. they had 1,500 of these skittish beasts being herded towards the Putiastana Valley. 300 of Madapo's feared Basutu pony-riding horsemen attacked Eyre, many wearing the uniforms and helmets of the dead lancers, which put the fear of hell into the regular troopers. These days, the rules of war say that if you wear the other side's uniform, you can be executed on the spot if you're caught. But the Basutu were making a point about being able to kill the cavalry by wearing their outfits. For the men of Eyre's section, the sight of their own lancers' uniforms meant the crack cavalrymen were dead, and this hit them like a lightning bolt. Bolapo piled into Eyre's mounted section, and in the fracas managed to take Captain Walter Faunce prisoner after killing his orderly. Eyre was personally involved in this hand-to-hand fight. A Basutu horseman took a swing at him, knocking off his hat with a knobkerrie. Had he struck the lieutenant colonel, it would have been curtains. Eyre pulled out his revolver and shot the attacker, then ordered his men into a defensive circle a la General Custer at Bighorn. Using the rocks as cover, both sides fired at each other, and as usual, it was Mother Earth who had the last laugh. A torrential thunderstorm suddenly broke overhead. Both sides stopped fighting. Eyre lost 5 men killed and 10 wounded during this operation. Sorry, make that 6 men. The death toll rose to 6 after the unfortunate Captain Faunce faced furious Basutu men. It turned out the British had shot women civilians in their lust for cattle, and someone had to pay. And that someone was Captain Faunce, who was promptly clubbed to death. English newspaper reports suggested later that Faunce was only taken prisoner because he was such a poor horseman, responsible for his own demise, in other words, and suffered the dishonour of being captured because he was not good enough. That's a bit rich, seeing that he was caught along with 30 other horsemen. They weren't all bad, were they? I suppose you have to make excuses in war. Malapo didn't escape unscathed. 50 of his men were killed, dozens more wounded, and hundreds of horses injured or dead. Eventually, at 5 p.m., Napier, Eyre, and Cathcart joined up at the base of the Berea, just after the thunderstorm lifted. The Basutu continued attacking this joint force, but this is where the Minié rifle I mentioned last episode came into its own. The Basutu were armed with older muskets that did not have the range of these latest rifles, with their expanding spinning rounds, and the British used the Minié effectively for the rest of the battle. Malapo tried to insert his warriors between the cavalry and the British regular troops as they withdrew, but the Minié peppered the Basutu. Battle over. The British had lost 38 men dead, dozens more wounded, and they were running out of ammunition. I explained last episode how Cathcart had thought that 60 rounds per man would be enough to see off the Basutu and left most of his ammo behind at the Platberg. A bad miscalculation. It was now 8 p.m., though, and both sides had had enough for the day. What, though, of the morrow, the 21st of December, 1852? A few lines in a letter was going to change everything. At midnight on the 20th of December, in the presence of French missionary Kasali, Moshoeshoe dictated a letter to his son Sekonyana, not to be confused with his enemy, Sekonyela. This letter was a stroke of diplomatic genius, written by a Basutu, the son of the king. Tabo Busio, midnight, 20 December, 1852. Your Excellency, this day you have fought against my people and taken much cattle. As the object for which you have come is to have compensation for Boers, I beg you will be satisfied with what you have then. I entreat peace from you. You have shown your power. You have chastised. Let it be enough, I pray you, and let me be no longer considered an enemy to the Queen. I will try all I can to keep my people in order in the future. Your humble servant, Moshesh. Cathcart had been in two minds until this letter showed up on the 21st. His officers were urging him to call for reinforcements from the Platbach, the other half of his army, bring them up with the ammunition, and smash Moshoeshoe for good. Instead, the British commander looked around him and counted the cost. 38 British soldiers dead, the most in any engagement thus far in South Africa. He had 5,000 Basutu cattle, hardly a small number, something to boast about. The Basutu king, in turn, had lost 50 men at least, dozens more injured, and written a letter that Cathcart could wave around. Peace in our time. Furthermore, Cathcart had been astonished by the fighting qualities of the Basutu and their numbers. He wasn't prepared to continue a war on a second front because he still had to somehow defeat Makoma and Amatosa. Moshoeshoe had provided Cathcart with a way out, a way to save face. So naturally, the Major General wrote a letter back.
Camp, Caledon River, 21st December, 1852. Chief Moshesh, I have received your letter. The words are those of a great chief and of one who has the interests of his people at heart. I have taken the fine by force, and I am satisfied. I consider your past obligations fulfilled and hope that you will take measures for preventing such abuses in future. In the meantime, as the Queen's representative, I subscribe myself, your friend.
I'm amazed at how brief and powerful communications were back in the day. A few words relay everything, don't they? What else is there to say? Cathcart returned to the Cape Colony with his troops, reporting that the expedition had resulted in the submission of the now enlightened and powerful Chief Moshesh. No cold war in the freezing Basutu Highlands, at least for now. More letters exchanged, perhaps even Christmas cards. It was this Anglo-Sutu relationship that was going to save Moshweshwe from an annexation by the Boer-led Orange Free State 15 years later. For both the Basutu and the British, the irony of this Battle of Berea is that it created a form of mutual admiration society. Relations were now amicable. They ended up as fond former enemies. With that, the British also decided to abandon the territory. And time to abandon this episode. Next, we'll skip back to the east, where Mpande, the AmaZulu, had some plans. So too did the British residents of Natal, and perhaps we'll have time to delve into the moves towards self-government. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform. It helps elevate the visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about this episode. You can also register for a newsletter. You can also mail me from there too. Until next, goodbye. Thank you.